1966.
They said there was one case because the town had been initially vilified.
That's what Stace said when you telephoned him.
There, yeah, where he went to me.
Oh, I see. The point is that the government seems to have suspected some of the nationalist leaders and thought they were behind the riots. In fact, Stubbs definitely felt so.
Yes. Well, I got a copy on that impression. Did Collins talk to you about that at all?
Yes. He felt there was some organization behind it, but
yeah,
that it was not premeditated.
But it was premeditated.
No, that it was not premeditated.
No, I'm sure it wasn't.
But the point is that Stubbs and, not Chalmers, but Stubbs and then the Police Inquiry Commission said that it was premeditated.
Mm. Well, at that time, everybody knows about German spies and infiltration and that kind of thing. I think they read into it all sorts of things went there. The business of putting a DVD artillery and 7 hour tension was the most ridiculous thing I've ever thought.
It would seem that some Syrianese themselves, some Syrianese who had the ear of government, spread stories, and this influenced the government action.
Mm. Well, it was. Yes, and I never forgot that. Gatilka did, but Semenarka didn't. Every now and again, he'd get in his let drive about it.
What about Dr. W.A. De Silva?
I don't know. I never came across him very much. He was dead by the time I got into politics.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't count a very great deal. It was and David Gatilka did. On the whole, I mean, it's only just occasionally that Selmayr let drive about that, but he really saw him about it. And he was a member of the town guard, and he would have turned out against them.
I think the General Malcolm was a big ducky.
Hmm.
And he was treating it like a Boer War.
Yeah. The same idea, you see. People like that and the government and the army, they had their eye on the situation in Europe.
Mm.
There's a tremendous lot of stuff about spies. Now, certain, I'm mentioning names, somebody I knew in the last war, they're always saying that there's spies here, there and everywhere.
Well,
an officer? No, not an officer. Woman actually, but she was a very good one, but she was quite crackers about that. Well, just listen to her, but it was nonsense. That's the sort of feeling that some people had, you see. But, as far as the First War was concerned, Islam was except for the possibility of the end of the North Coast was practically untouched by the war of law. Very differently, after the war.
What were your impressions of the civil service in the 1920s? CCS proper.
Well, you've got to remember that on civil service and all colonial services were not of the same caliber as Indian or Home Civil Service.
Mm-hmm.
They're very conscientious. On the whole, pretty efficient. There are very few, what I call, really outstanding people.
Mm-hmm. Who struck you as being really outstanding?
Well, Sage was one, and Newham was another. Woods, of course, he came in a different way. He was an extremely able man.
Mm-hmm.
So, on his own point, we were Huxham. Neither of them were, all their members of Islam Civil Service, they hadn't come in.
Yes, I see.
You see, the trouble with the Islam Civil Service, unlike the Indian, was that any particularly able young men, or when they're approaching the forces, if they were good, they got drafted off somewhere else, the colonial secretaries or colonels or something like that. So that the cream was always all skimmed off the civil service. Some people are so fond of Islam they didn't want to get moved. Collins, for example, he was very fond of Islam. I don't suppose he'd been offered a whether he was or not, I think I said, yeah, but he wouldn't have wanted, I think, particularly if he ever moved from Islam. Very fond of it and very interested. I always thought civil service should have taken more interest than it did in the history and the customs of the place. Now, Bassett, he was a fellow who was very interested in Ceylon and the Ceylonese. He went out of his way to find all sorts of things out. Mind you, he was always very rather the light touch. But there were some charming books. And dived into all kinds of interesting details.
Codrington did some work.
Codrington, of course, was very good indeed. Codrington was a real scholar, and
how was he
quite a capable historian, too.
How was he as an administrator, as far as you know?
I think he was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Then again, I don't know why he didn't go on. I was, when I used to talk with Codrington, about 5 minutes, he was completely out of my depth. He was a very learned man indeed, because he was very fine knowledge of Sinhalese. Of course, one of the most remarkable people was Freeman.
Yes.
Oh, he's an astounding man. So I only met him once, unfortunately. I wish I'd met him more, because he never came to Colombo if he could possibly help it.
Did you feel that he was impractical in his ideas?
No, I don't think so. In a sense, I suppose, he was a single-track mind. People who are that way are apt to be trifling and practical, but I think Freeman was... I don't know if he was... He never wrote anything.
Yes.
I never had, as I say, had the opportunity of talking to him. He was so enormously interested in people. Do you ever have a story of his election?
No.
Oh. Now, he put up a... what was it? Was it Northwest? I've forgotten now, but anyhow. Now, what happened was this. You know the way he used to ride his bicycle all over the place?
Yes.
And he came across an old woman, a single age woman, in great state of distress. And she said that her son had was setting up some sort of business, and for that purpose he borrowed 300 rupees. And just as he'd really got the thing going, the lender, seeing that he'd made a good business, decided to foreclose on it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course he was quite upset. Freeman said, oh, it's all right, I should hear 300 rupees, pay off the debt, and then also I'll repay me in time. Told them all about it. However, when the election came, So a woman came along. She said she heard that Freeman Dorrie was going to have been a member of the State Council. And she'd like to vote for him. And they said they're very sorry, but she hadn't put her name down on the register and wasn't eligible to vote. She sat by the polling booth and composed a sort of song extolling all the wonderful things that Freeman Dorrie had done for her. She had enormous influence. People came along and heard this, oh, they're going to vote for him, and of course he got in. Of course it might have been anyhow, but... Because they say Freeman, the sort of thing Freeman did, you see, he thought no more about it. He knew the young man was all right, and he was being unfairly treated. So he said, all right, for 300 rupees, I can get it back. Thought no more of it. There are very few people with his temperament and all kind of a...
Don't you think that the civil service could have done with more Freemans?
Yes. So I was saying just now, there weren't enough people who took a real interest in that, or rather above the details of administration.
Administration.
Mind you, they had plenty to do as such.
Mm-hmm.
But my impression was that, I don't want to quote it, that the civil servants who lived outside Colombo did get to know the people better.
Mm-hmm.
They mixed more in the local pubs, like places like Ostley or...
Mm-hmm.
They got to know the Sudanese. When they came to Colombo, there was this regular round of social life that the European community lived. And the influential people in that, of course, were not government servants, they were the business people.
Mm-hmm.
And they worked in their offices, and then they went along to one of the pubs and played tennis. Then they probably sat down and played bridge, and then they went home and went to bed. Well, there's always a certain amount of that kind of thing, tennis, bridge, parties, what have you. And civil servants rather got drawn into that.
Lost touch with the trend
of... Lost touch with the people. Except in so far, of course, as their ordinary business was concerned. Well, some of them, of course, depended on what particular job you were in.
This is very interesting because, you see, Stace, in his final review, says that raises this point as one of his major criticisms. He makes the point that the civil service, that the British community were rather too aloof, and yeah, also goes further and accuses them of arrogance too.
That has a certain amount of truth in it. It varied with the person. Civil servants always thought themselves rather cut above anybody else.
I should have thought...
To put it this way, the other government servants, like the PWD survey and so forth, resented that a good deal.
Mm-hmm.
They said they are experts in their own particular job. Civil servants weren't experts in anything except administration. And that there's no reason for them to rate themselves as high as they did.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not only thinking of that, and as far as Stace was concerned, he was referring to the whole community, and I think this included the businessmen and the planters, but he's referring to, well, to the racial prejudice and arrogance which some of them showed.
Yes.
A few civil servants, perhaps.
Yes, I think... The civil servants were very much better than the business community.
Yes.
The business community, there were very few. There were some outstanding examples of men who were in business, took a real interest. Mr. Monnington now, I've forgotten what his firm was. It's best, it doesn't matter. But he was really interested. He used to come to the meetings of the Royal Asiatic Society, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I always said that the whole civil service should have belonged to that. Now, Turner, there's no one there, admirable. And he's really interested, and he did some really good works, you know. That book of his on the Maritime Provinces is very good.
Mm-hmm.
Turner was exactly the right type. Now, the average civil servant, well, his point was that he was a very busy man.
Mm-hmm.
And when he had time off, he wanted to have recreation. Because sport was a thing that the brought the community together about as much as anything.
Yes, that's true. As part of this,
I'll tell you the thing. There's a fellow called Davis.
R-M-E-H?
No, not a civil servant at all. He's a businessman. And he's very keen on sport. I know a fellow saying, Davis, so he's playing soccer with a lot of pins.
Mm.
Well, it's a jolly good thing he was.
Yes.
I said, I think that's admirable. But it was said in a nasty way.
Yes, that shows some sort of prejudice, doesn't it?
Yeah. What do you want to do that for, you know? What do you want to play a lot of pins?
Well, another thing that occasionally hit the headlines was when somebody... In one case, I know it was Forrest, who was a civil servant, chucked a Ceylonese out of a first-class compartment.
Oh, yeah.
Things like that.
Mm. Yes, well, that's no excuse for that sort of thing at all. Very, very bad. Yes, I know that there was an occasion, a bit of a row about it, when a man did that, but... The fact of the matter was that this occupying seat was being reserved for him. So the same thing might have happened if the other man hadn't been a Ceylonese.
Yeah,
but the Ceylonese are very touchy, or can be.
Did they imagine...
What used to... what I noticed was... a great many people did their very best to be friendly and so forth, but there only one thing had to happen of that kind.
did they imagine slights where there were none?
It was apt to happen, yes. Or if there were slights, it was very considerably stressed. One example was this. You know when Governor Manning was governor,
mm-hmm.
in the old Legislative Council, somebody, I've forgotten who it was, whether it was Ranelagh, and I don't think it was, but anyway, a fairly leading Ceylonese, was attacking the, some question about civil service pay or
something. Mm-hmm.
And he was his point was that they were well paid and they had all sorts of luxuries. They must have their creme de menthe. And Manning said, it's usually called creme de menthe. That's awful out about that. Of course, Manning shouldn't have said it, but he was a little annoyed with the way, of course, he was presiding, you see,
mm-hmm.
the way that this man thought he was being rather unfair. So he just jerked that out. Well, the governor had insulted this man and so forth. Well, if it had been the other man who'd said that, no notice had been taken of it, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a simple example.
Yes, I see.
But it's quite natural, in a way.
Since
I've been connected with this Commonwealth Parliamentary Association, of course, I've come across actually all the developing countries, and I always realise their point of view. A lot of the British people just couldn't understand why they were resented at all. They said, oh, we've come here doing our best, and we've done a great deal for the country, and they are always resentful. I tell you a thing that happened to me again, I'm not mentioning names, but a certain Chinese lady I knew pretty well, directly after independence, she said to me, she said, two people came around to see us, two Europeans. They said, the whole time, she said, they were saying, oh, making an awful point of what the British had done to Ceylon and so forth. And I thought, very, very bad. I said, now look here, I said, you've got a brain. A year ago, would they have said that? She said, no, they were quite right, they wouldn't. I said, well, that's the whole point. They wouldn't have said it a year ago, and they're saying it now. Because things are not the same as they were, not at all. But it's not in control any longer. And they feel, these two people felt that what the British general was on needed a certain amount of stressing. That was their point of view. A year ago they wouldn't have mentioned it. Now they've done it. He said, oh, you're quite right, I see your point.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel that the politicians suffered from an inferiority complex?
To a certain extent, yes. Again, it's absolutely natural. It should be that way, because, I say, the British were occupying power.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, they, people of Ceylon had no control of their own affairs.
One of the aspects which seemed to annoy Ceylonese was the question of Ceylonese public servants or civil servants not being made GAs, any GAs,
yeah, for
some time. And I wonder if there was a deliberate policy, or rather what I would call a tendency, sort of, without anything written down, a tendency to exclude them from these posts for some time.
There was a tendency for some time. Take a man like Penambula Malinotulam,
mm-hmm,
who was distinctly sidetracked. And they didn't make him GA, they made him Registrar General. Mm-hmm. And he did an extremely good job. But they woke up to that in time. Of course, Sir Wickham Singh was the first GA.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering why they did so.
Well, it's all difficult to say.
You see, I've seen a memo written by Bowles. He uses various arguments against the higher employment of Ceylonese. One...
Who was that?
Freddie Bowles.
Oh, Freddie Bowles, oh yeah.
One was that... the stability of government would be affected, and that Ceylonese could not be relied on in a crisis. Another was that the people themselves would never trust the impartiality of one of their own number.
Of course, I've heard that argument advanced quite often. And of course, the other, it's rather based on this idea, not strictly Sloan, but. The rather more with regard to India. In India, the family, the kinship tie is very much stronger,
mm-hmm,
than it is in Europe, in this country in particular. And that, that being so, is a duty of a man to look after his family,
mm-hmm,
and as long as a man had the tendency, if you like, to put his family above the state, then you get nepotism.
Mm-hmm.
That's the argument. And that the Sudanese were not far enough advanced in what you might call sense of public duty to put the state above family.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, kind of idea behind that.
The way Boers
it hasn't worked that way. Of course, Freddie Boers was quite one of the old school.
Mm-hmm. Yes, as I said, the way he writes, one sort of feels that he's rationalizing his prejudices.
Yeah. I think that's a fair statement.
I was wondering whether in the case of these old school people, it was also a question of status. Since the DA was God Almighty in his district, I wondered whether they didn't want a non-European in that post. Certainly the planters would have objected.
Yes. Because the planters are very, very backwoodsmen.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to remember that the average planter, the upcountry planter in particular, never came across seeing these.
Mm-hmm.
The only people he came across were his fellow planters and his Tamil labour force.
Mm-hmm.
Except for sport.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that didn't come across them. I remember a friend of mine who's, he was a planter, a low country planter, who said, oh, so-and-so, particularly objectionable planter, he's probably never even seen a thing of these. Just doesn't know they exist. Because he was making a joke about it. That was the case with that one. Now take men like R.C. Scott. He had quite the reverse idea. He was a proprietor, very last of the upland proprietary planters, very keen Freemason, and his relations, though he was an extremely tactless man, that wasn't his fault. I mean, but he did his very best to mix with the Sudanese. He was back in the middle of a country district called Tekoa, where I say you didn't come across Sinhalese very much at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, Sinhalese, the people of Ceylon, what you came across, except for a certain number of masons, carpenters, and occasionally somebody in the office, who the only people came across were the town labour force.
Mm-hmm.
They were there to grow tea or rubber, whatever it was, that's their function now. Learning all the hard work. And when they got off, a short time, there wasn't a very great deal of leisure time for planter, which he could spend with his fellow beings, fellow planters. He could only do it by going to the club once a week or something like that. He had a certain amount of time in his bungalow, where he was on his own, possibly one or two people around. That's especially the case in the early days, of course, before motor cars.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, that was that. He didn't meet anybody. If he met anybody, he wanted to meet his own kind. There's a book, now what it's called, by Charles Caddington. You read in his stuff?
No.
He was a professor of Commonwealth Studies or something at the Chatham House. He wrote a book in which he said, well, very natural that people should, you know, away from home, should mix their own in their own tubs. Well, that is the case. But the it always annoyed me tremendously. I mean, take the Columbo Club, for example.
Mm-hmm.
For years, no Sudanese were allowed inside it. And eventually, that got broken down. And I was living at Clamber Club some time. I used to make a point of inviting some of these friends of mine come and dine with me. All over Martin's, I used to have him every week. I used to go to him once a week, and he used to come dine with me once a week. Dixonard I used to have along, and others too. And eventually, the membership was thrown open. Of course, it should have been done years before. I tell you a funny thing, Robert. We had a little club which was called 20 Club.
Mm-hmm.
And it consisted entirely of, it was a highbrow affair, mm-hmm. if I could put it that way. People who were interested in some subject or experts on some subject used to meet once a month after dinner. And the only qualification was that you had something worth saying. The host's job was to read a paper. You came in, you had coffee, and then you sat down, the host read a paper, and then after that you had some drinks and sat around and discussed it, often small hours of the morning. And then there were people of all races there.
Mm-hmm.
Now you'd think that the easy thing would be to get to sit on these members, and the difficult thing would be to get to our friends, get it all the way around. Take it as a member. Might be I myself said, I think so and so, Mr. Pretty Good Warden, would be a good man, member of this club. Silly, no, he wouldn't do it at all. It's difficult to get them to let other Sudanese in.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
Whether it was because they varied the membership and sought for something rather special, or whether they had other reasons, I don't know. No.
I wonder whether the caste came into it at all. Because you would
may have come in a little. Not very much. Oh, caste is very interesting. I used to find it wasn't until you got to know the Sudanese really well that he would think to talk about it. As a rule, he just wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
E.W. Pereira, I remember I knew him very well.
Mm-hmm. How did he strike you?
Nice little man. I was very fond of him, and he had a real enthusiasm for scholarship research. We're finding out the manners and customs and the history and so forth. And I happened to be going up to Kandy by train, and E.W. Pereira got in the same compartment. It must have been about 1925, I think, when there was a great controversy about the site of the university, whether it should be in Colombo or it should be in Kandy.
What were you for?
On the whole, I was in favour of Colombo. I hadn't a very strong idea, as some people had. But he said, you know, of course, it's really a cost matter. I said, a cost matter? It can't be the lowest. The Kandians, for the most part, want it up there.
Mm-hmm.
And the low country Sudanese and the trial in particular, you know, I heard in Colombo. Well, I was astonished.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't been out very long, and I hadn't come across caste to any extent. And I was so interested, I tried to find out a bit more about it. I discovered that the average Sudanese didn't want to talk about it if he could possibly help it.
Mm-hmm. Quite likely.
But when I got to know them, I got to know, well, from the nature of my job as a professor at university, I got to know the average Sudanese very much better than the vast majority of Europeans. Because I mixed with them. I mean,
on the staff, and of course all the students, well, practically all the students were Sudanese. They got to know me well. And they talked to me, and they probably wouldn't talk even to a civil servant.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I came to appreciate their point of view well, better than most people.
One of the reasons why they may have been reluctant to make Sudanese and non-Europeans GAs was the genuine feeling, I think it was genuine in this case, that Sudanese were not good at accepting responsibility, or they tended to shell responsibility.
Yes, that certainly was their point of view.
How far was it correct, though?
It's not justified.
Mm-hmm.
On the whole, I think the Sudanese were less willing to accept responsibility than the average European civil servant, because to begin with, the European civil servant came out with that idea
mm-hmm.
of that he was responsible and so forth for the government of the country, or his particular bit of it, and that he was impartial, whereas the average Sudanese hadn't got the responsibility to take. He was kept out of higher ranks of mm-hmm. civil service and got induced to take responsibility. And so up to a point had limited amount of justification. And of course the other point was that the big point, I think, was this one of impartiality.
Mm-hmm.
Would a Sudanese GA be favourable to people his own caste or his own family?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the sort of feeling was that he probably would. To a certain extent, that is the case.
But the point was this exclusion of it is not merely exclusion of Sudanese GAs, but even the Indians, and if I may say so, the West Indians were excluded from GA ships. And they had no attachments in the country.
Hmm. Is that the case now?
Yes, Wadia was the first, one of the first with C.L. Vikramasinghe. But till yeah. then...
There aren't a great many.
No, but... you see, it was noticeable that they were shunted into the judicial line.
Oh, hmm.
If I could sort of turn to another subject, as a related aspect, what about the civil servants' knowledge of the vernacular? Didn't you feel that it was rather limited?
Yes. It wasn't altogether their fault, because the average educated Sudanese always preferred speaking English.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I always remember a play that was put on in the thing called the Union Hostel, the University College. There are three hostels, a Catholic, one run by sort of Church of England people, and the Union Hostel, and then the to sing these in Tamil. The Tamil put on a play. In Tamil, but they had a Sudanese government servant, a Tamil government servant, I mean, taking the part of a Tamil government servant, and he refused to speak in Tamil. If anybody asked him a question in Tamil, he answered in English.
Oh, I see.
Of course, they were getting it. It was, they were getting it, that sort of feeling, but I was very amused at the time, but it does rather illustrate my point. That's one thing, but I think they were on the whole rather lazy about it. They should have done very much more to make themselves acquainted with what we describe as the vernaculars.
Yeah, you
and they did. A lot of them regarded it a bit of a chore. They had to pass the exam. The exam in Singhalese and or Tamil. I've forgotten whether it was one or both. I don't remember exactly. But they did it and then they forgot about it because they didn't use it.
Yes.
On the other hand, there were other people like Hodrington and Freeman who...
Campbell, Graham.
Excuse me. Writing anything special?
No, I will be, well, possibly I might. I will be pretty busy for the next 2 years because I have to start off on my lectures.
Lectures, really.
And,
what are you going to take?
I'm not quite certain yet until I get back.
Are you fluent in Singhalese?
No, I'm not very fluent. That'll be a bit of a struggle to master it.
Yes, because you have to act in Singhalese, won't you?
Yes, I will. Both, possibly some English, but mostly Singhalese.
It seems to me, you know, the big difficulty the university is experiencing is the lack of books.
Mm, that's right.
What do you think these students, my information is, doing? I mean, those who either who don't know English, or English is rather weak, they just stick some textbook and reproduce that in the notes on their lectures.
Yes, right.
And don't get any real education at all.
Mm-hmm.
However, it's because they have rushed the thing so much. Political reasons. Unfortunate.
Yes. What were your impressions of the education system in the 20s and 30s?
It was gradually changing from English education. I don't misunderstand me at the moment. When I got out there, education had far too English bias altogether. Things were perfectly ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
People studied English history and they never studied Ceylon history.
Mm-hmm.
Partly due to the fact, of course, Ceylon history wasn't written to any extent. And partly, I think, due to the influence of mission schools.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some quite capable people. McCrae was a very capable man, director of education. Harrison was a very capable man. I've forgotten when McCrae came out.
20s, I should think.
It was in the 20s, yes. A fellow called Evans was awfully good at this. So I thought he had some points, but...
Old school, was he? Old-fashioned?
Yes. He'd been brought up sort of, you know, teacher's training kind of thing. He was not really what I call an educated man in the best sense of the word.
Yes, I see.
Because Denham, you know, he was a civil servant, and he very definitely took over, chose to take the job of director of education.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting. It wasn't the kind of job that civil servants normally occupied. I don't know if there had been any civil servants before who were directors of education. He very definitely did it and did an extremely good job of work. Of course, he was moved on.
Mm-hmm. Was he a particularly brilliant type of...?
I believe so. I never met him myself. Mm. He was before my time, slightly before. But... he really understood the absolute necessity of education. But it had far too much British slant.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt at all. Because English education in the normal sense of the word, I mean education in English,
mm-hmm.
Was necessary for people who wanted to get in government service.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, that was one of the object of education in the 19th century.
Yes, I was one
people for government jobs. It's not at all fair to say that's the only object, it was one of them. But it was in Dutch times.
But I was wondering whether it was far too aligned to turning out. It was sort of more or less a clerk's administrator's education.
And the vernacular education, as they called, was simply the poor relations.
Infradig too, wasn't it?
Infradig, yeah.